Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning, everyone. This is Johnny Tan, author of From My Mama's Kitchen, Food for the Soul, Recipes for Living. Welcome to my weekly From My Mama's Kitchen talk radio show. My guest for this morning is actor Rick Lentz. His new memoir, titled North of Hollywood, offers deep insights into his life as an actor, husband, and father. Rick and I will be talking about his spiritual journey, along with plenty of showbiz anecdotes. Good morning, Rick. Welcome to From My Mama's Kitchen Talk Radio. How are you doing this morning?
I'm doing very well, Johnny. Thank you for having me on.
North of Hollywood is wonderfully written. From the chapter to the last, I was totally engaged, and I have to tell you this, besides the stories of the various Hollywood stars, it is all about love, the relationship that you have with your family and especially your wife. And to me, it is definitely a must-read for everyone who enjoys Hollywood and a beautiful love story. Congratulations.
Oh, thank you. Well, that was what I hoped would be the heart of the book. That's what I really wanted to do more than anything because, there are lots of people who are famous and you really want to hear their show business stories. But, despite my success, I thought what I really had best to offer after a lifetime and doing this was my personal story and, in a way, my kind of a story of redemption in a way.
Let us talk about your childhood years. Give us a quick walkthrough of your life from childhood to the present moment.
Sure. I was in World War II. I came into this living world and I spent the first few years. My dad was a doctor in the Army Air Force. That's when the Air Force used to be part of the Army, so that dates me, I'm afraid. But so we kind of moved around the West from Colorado Springs to Salt Lake City, Utah, and Lincoln, Nebraska, and a few places where he was working, where he worked processing soldiers into the Air Force. And that was my first experience, and just watching the world from all these little. Not little places at all. They were big places in mostly the West. And then we moved back to where I was raised, which was in Jackson, Michigan. That was a nice place to grow up because it's a good city and the people are good, solid people. Then I went to University of Michigan, and I had a sister who was 10 years younger than I am, and then I just was planning to be a doctor like my father, but I actually went and watched him do a surgical procedure one time, and I really wanted to see what goes on up close, and I found myself just sort of. I don't really remember it that well, but I kind of remember my eyes going up toward the ceiling, and then the next thing I knew, I was unconscious, and my dad was stitching up a couple of little where I fell, and he said, "Well, this happens to lots of people who are going to be doctors," but I think he knew even then that I was not cut out for this, and. If I'm rattling on too much, you'll stop me.
Oh, no, not at all. It's wonderful for people to know about your beginnings because a lot of times when we talk about real life, real people, sometimes people can really relate to what these individuals were in the very beginning of their career. And in your case, you have a wonderful span of career. And I thought that in reading your book, you have so much to offer in terms of, hey, I'm an ordinary people just like you. But certain things within me that drove me all this while, and this is a journey that I took, and I'd like to share all of these with you right now.
Right. I understand. I love what you do, by the way. I love.
Thank you.
Yes. I'm more attracted to the notion, especially for young people of kind of figuring out how to do things. Like I know it's a cliche in a way, but follow your bliss or. Mm-hmm. Figure out what that is and find ways to be able to do that so that you're living your work life as if it's you know, it's one and the same almost with your having fun life. I think it's just awfully important.
Well, you found the magic answer to everything. You enjoy your entire career because a career is a hobby that you do and you get paid for it.
Yes, exactly. So I can't, somebody else said that too, and I can't remember who, but that sure is the case. I it was for me as though I was not able to do anything but this. And I tried lots of jobs. I did some teaching, and I did a lot of those jobs that actors do, both in Michigan, where I began by being director of a civic theater in my hometown for 2 years, and I directed and built the sets for 12 shows during those 2 years, and it was a great learning experience. In fact, it was kind of on-the-job training. But then also when I got to New York, between the work itself, between the acting work and the directing work, that kind of thing, I had to make a living, and so that involved working as a file clerk and a desk clerk at a hotel, and a long list of things that weren't things I wanted to do for my lifetime, but were things that I had to do to keep floating and keep alive, and so I was able to finally get some jobs. And I actually just remembered how I got my first job. It was somebody I'd met referred me to an agent in New York, and I was in that agent's office, and he was saying, "Well, I don't think you have enough experience. I don't know what I'd send you out for," and that kind of thing. And I was just really still a kid as far as I was concerned, or especially looking at it now. And somebody walked by. A woman walked by. Her name was Maggie Henderson. She's a wonderful agent and wonderful lady. And she walked by and said, "Are you an actor?" And I said, "Yes. Yes, ma'am." Yep. And she said, "Well, come back." She handed me a script and said, "Come back in an hour and read for this." And I did. It was for a playhouse called Bucks County Playhouse in Pennsylvania. And I came back that hour later and read. And the producer said, "Are you Equity?" Which is the actors' stage union. And I said, "Yes," which was a lie. And he said, "No, you're not." And I said, "Oh, caught me." And no, I'm not. You're right. And so I went home thinking I'd blown it, and I was just really down about it. And I got home, and just not that much longer, I got a call from that agent, and I had gotten the job.
That's wonderful.
Yeah,
that's
it was a memorable moment for me, because the idea of being paid for doing what I loved was just just beyond what I could hope for.
That's fantastic. You were actually growing up during the golden years of Hollywood, where movie making was making that transition from after the war.
Yeah.
There were a lot of great actors that you have actually encountered personally. As a child, when did you discover you wanted to get into acting and writing? And, you were one of those guys that grew up playing cowboys and Indians, those kind of things.
Exactly so, yeah. And we'd play war, that I think about that expression makes me, I have very mixed feelings about that.
That's
because,
right.
Because I hate the whole notion of war. But we played all those games, and I can't tell you the number of times I died in the playground and in some vacant lot and so on. And actually, I don't know if you went through this at all, but it was kind of like how you could die, out in your friend's backyard while you were all playing these kind of games was a skill to be developed.
Right. Very true.
Yeah, that was fun. And I found that I loved showing off. I wasn't exactly the class clown, because I was also kind of shy, but I think somehow it often happens with entertainers, actors, that they overcome their shyness with the exact opposite, which is exhibitionism in a way. I don't mean the subway kind, but you know what I mean.
Yeah. Were you ever in a situation where you wanted to relieve a life of sort of a fantasy, playing a different role, because that's sort of giving you an opportunity to live a different life? It's sort of a daydreaming kind of thing.
Yeah, oh yeah, absolutely. Oh gosh, yes. I remember, you know, I'd come home from the movies and you know, I'd imagine myself as these characters, and I think it happens to, I hope it happens to a lot of kids, otherwise I'm crazy. it was great fun doing pretend, and then finally I was playing I wanted to be an athlete, was that was how you got girls back in those days.
Right.
It seemed to me, and then I found out that I was just a little bit too breakable to be a football player. So and then I got into a play, and then another school play, and then summer stock and so on, and I discovered that, you know, it's much nicer to win, you know, to try to get the girl, you know, play a love scene with her than it is for the cross an athletic field, you know.
Very interesting.
Much more to the point, yeah.
Right, very interesting. You are an esteemed playwright as well. How is writing a book different from a play?
Wow. It's essentially the same thing. It's telling a story. The thing about a play is you're concentrating naturally on dialogue, because it's all told by, or usually all told by the actors, you know, talking. And in a book, in any kind of most book kinds of book, you need a narrative flow. So it's just, I think the principles of storytelling are the same in both. You know, there are obviously differences in what you expect when you go to see a play. I remember a definition of theater being life with the dull parts left out. But that really kind of needs to be the case also in most kinds of literature, too, I think. You just don't want to, you know, at least... non-academic. You don't want to, you know, just fill people with, you know, a lot of information that they, you know, they can't use. I think the primary purpose of, you know, the kind of writing I do anyway is to entertain. And if I can, you know, get something of a message or whatever I have to say, you know, I hate the word message, but whatever I have to say in among the entertaining, then that's all plus.
That's understandable. What is the inspiration behind North of Hollywood?
I've always been a playwright, and I did the playwriting between acting gigs just to keep from going mad. It was one of the reasons, and all actors have to learn at some point, you know, what you do between jobs, because there's always a lot of time between jobs, at least for most actors. And I wrote plays, and so I also, you know, kept diaries and notes and so on. And so I had these, you know, kind of episodes, or, you know, actually I would come home from doing a film job or a play, you know, a rehearsal of a play, and I would write notes that had to do with something that seemed interesting to me. And then later on, I kind of sifted through all those things, and it was at a time, not that many years, quite recently, when some sort of serious things were happening in my life, and I thought it was a good time. It seemed to me to kind of blend everything together and talk about, you know, my career and interweave it with the kind of current time events that were happening in my life.
Well, you did an excellent job, because I thought the entire book, besides the funny anecdotes about the various actors that you have worked with, and people that you have encountered over the span of the last several decades, so to speak, then you have this wonderful, wonderful story about human relationship, about you, and how you yourself evolve as a human being. And I thought that was fascinating.
Oh, thank you so much. It's been just really gratifying. In fact, last week I found out that I won the Los Angeles Book Award for biography, autobiography, and it was set at the Roosevelt Hotel, where I think the first Academy Awards were. So they had the ceremony last Saturday, and I picked that up, and it was very gratifying. In fact, someone told me I'd won an award, and I thought, well, I wasn't in anything this year, and they told me it was a literary award, and
yeah.
It was just surreal because I didn't expect to be recognized for this at all.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm awfully pleased about it.
Well, congratulations! You certainly deserve it because the book is definitely must read for people that are really into just getting the stories behind the stories in Hollywood, and having the opportunity to sort of really experiencing the behind the scenes, and at the same time, understanding the process of human evolution in terms of relationships and so forth, and the challenges of life and so forth. Who is the book intended for?
I think for me, you know, when I write a scene, I want to first satisfy myself, and then as I go along, if I think that it's going to be whatever it is, whether it's a play or a book, I want it to be, you know, for as many people as I can, you know, possibly write for. I like to have a book that's you know, anything that I read anyway. I think I'm interested in things that have a kind of universal appeal that and you mentioned spiritual journey, and and I like this is something that I was not really, you know, much involved with until the last few years, and and I just I'd had psychotherapy and all that kind of thing, and I realized that that there are some things that, you know, I can't answer for myself, and that there's got to be something bigger than me, and also my daughter, and this was kind of the pivotal point in the book, was a rock and roll singer and had a group called Swamp Boogie Queen, and they were under contract to Phil Ramone and in a big record company, and they toured and had a record, and they seemed very successful, and it looked like they would go on and be successful, you know, indefinitely. But, you know, as the music business, I think I say in the book, is about as you can depend on about as you can't depend on it. And so it things fell apart for her, and she got it. My daughter Abigail got involved in some the kind of problems that singers, especially rock singers, sometimes get involved with, and it was a drug thing, and so she went through a lot of hard times of going into rehab and doing that kind of thing, and it just seems like a terrible, you know, terrible joke in a way, but there's nothing funny about it, and that was really the point where I began to look into spiritual things, because I knew she had to deal with that. I remember once taking her to a rehab, and after we talked for a while with the woman who had the say as to whether they would take her in, she asked Abigail if she had spiritual resources, I think was the term she used, and my daughter glanced over at me, and it was almost heartbreaking, and she said, "My father and I are very spiritual," which was news to me. But it was maybe kind of what I remember as the trigger point for kind of starting me off in that direction and making me think along those lines.
Yeah. As a follow-up question, that affected you tremendously as a father, because that changes your entire thought process, I would think.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. You see your loved baby just go through something that's just, you know, horrific. And it's as though, you know, it's as though it's happening to you, and it feels terribly personal. I don't mean that I didn't know that it was her who was doing the suffering, but I could feel it along with her. I guess it was Bill Clinton who used to say, "I feel your pain." Well, I sure felt my daughter's pain. And,
very true. Your book is filled with many turning points in your personal life. Can you share some of those major ones?
Well, I guess the maybe the first one that comes to my mind, aside from when I was directing the Civic Theater in Michigan, and an old character actor named Walter Slezak, who was the son of a famous old Austrian tenor named Leo Slezak. I think there's actually an actor with that name. It's, they're not related. But Walter Slezak came through town, and he'd written a book, an autobiography, and he gave a speech, and I, because I was directing the theater, introduced him, and I asked him later on, I said, what would you do if you were going to begin a career? Would you go to New York or Hollywood? And he said, he kind of looked at me up and down, I said, well, looking at you, I think if you go to Hollywood, they'll just put you on a horse. Because it was still back in the time when they were making quite a few Westerns. So
right.
I took his advice and went the other way. I went to New York and did a lot of mm-hmm. you know, work on stage and mm-hmm. after I got going anyway.
In those moments that you were taking advice for
sure.
a personal turning points in your life, that was one of them because you ended up mm-hmm. in New York versus Hollywood.
Right.
And I think one of the fascinating things you were talking about in terms of where you're obviously introvert. This is very interesting about actors because people don't realize that they think that all actors are extrovert. And
oh,
they're not.
Yeah. Well, no, was I ever not an extrovert. I mean, I was in some ways. When
right.
I get on stage, I'm the worst ham in the world. I've heard, I remember people, a couple of apprentices at theaters saying, how do you have the guts to do that? Mm-hmm. When I did some kind of terribly, you know, sort of show-offy kind of thing or, you know,
right.
a big, broad thing in a play or whatever it was. But mm-hmm. Other than that, when I first got to New York, I was scared to death. I kind of pretty much stayed in my shabby hotel room for the mm-hmm. first, I lived in a walk-up hotel. It was not in a nice area, and it was sort of scary. It would have been... It wouldn't be scary to me now, but mm-hmm. I just didn't know what that was. It just looked like a really, really foreign place to be.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, after I'd been in New York for a year, I just I had a couple of jobs. I went back to Michigan for a few months, and I remember I was driving to Ann Arbor, which was like 40 miles from where I was raised mm-hmm. In Michigan, and I signed up to get a master's degree.
Mm-hmm.
And I was on my way home, driving home, and I thought to myself, I can't do this. I have to go back to New York, because if I don't, I'm going to hate myself forever.
Mm-hmm.
So I packed up and went again. In the meantime,
mm-hmm.
I already had a wife and two sons. So
mm-hmm.
it was a dicey time. But I went back to New York, and from then on, I didn't turn back.
Very interesting. What was the most difficult chapter for you to write in the book?
Well, you know, there were some several difficult things. To begin with, I was really, in a lot of ways, because I come from a kind of a dysfunctional family.
Mm-hmm.
My parents were good people, but they were also they had their ghosts.
Mm-hmm.
And that haunted them, and so dealing with how childishly I behaved in the beginning. I was, by the time I got to New York, I knew what to do, or I knew a lot of how to be an actor. I learned that, but what I hadn't learned to be was a responsible adult. So I guess one of the hardest things was the breakup of both my marriages. I was married twice before. My current 30-year marriage to Linda, and the marriages didn't work out. You hate causing pain. You hate being. I mean, sometimes the learning process is,
mm-hmm.
And becoming. Taking the kind of route that I took was. Involves other people. Everything you do,
mm-hmm.
we're all so interrelated, and I wish I'd been smarter than I was. I'm not unhappy about where I am. I couldn't be happier about where I am
mm-hmm.
right now. But so it's difficult writing about some of those changes,
mm-hmm.
Some of those partings, and
mm-hmm.
And it was also hard writing about my daughter, because I felt in large part responsible for what
mm-hmm.
she was going through. I know that's not the way it works entirely, but I was, to a degree. I can't deny that I shared responsibility for what was happening to her and with her. So, but on the other hand, some of those things do help you get to be a better person.
Mm-hmm.
When you realize that, you know, if I behave, you know, in this kind of way, then bad things happen not only to me but to other people. It's like the old thing, you know, what you give out is what you get back,
right,
one way or another. And I know that's a sort of a spiritual.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it's not a cliche. It's just the truth, I think.
Right. Right.
Yeah.
Were there heroes in the industry that helped you to decipher the business side of the equation as well as in your personal life?
Not so much in the business way. That
mm-hmm.
And that was just my own, you know, fault for not mm-hmm. knowing, you know, where to look for the right kind of guidance. And I was... Also, I was so young and stupid that I just didn't listen to the people who gave me the good advice along the
mm-hmm.
sort of business lines. And I think, you know, maybe it's part of growing up, but it seemed my growing up was kind of delayed more than a lot of my, you know, compatriots and
mm-hmm.
colleagues and so on. And so I had to learn those the hard way. Some of the people who inspired me artistically
mm-hmm.
were... I remember Alan Alda. I did a play
mm-hmm.
with him
mm-hmm.
early on, and he was he'd been associated with Second City, and he did. I may be wrong about that, but anyway, he was with as a book called Improvisation for Theater by
mm-hmm.
Viola Spolin, who was the mother of Paul Sills, who I think began Second City in Chicago, and we so after we opened our play. Alan and the rest of the cast. Alan would lead improv groups, and in a way, it's a kind of acting training, which I think is invaluable because
mm-hmm.
it keeps you alive. And a lot of this, you know, a lot of my generation of actors, and it's still happening, come from, you know, comedy and
mm-hmm.
improv. And I think it's, you know, one of the greatest learning skills possible. One of the things that Alan said to us. And it's, you know, it's part of the Viola Spolin material, is that you don't want to judge when
mm-hmm.
you're working. You don't want to make value judgments.
Mm-hmm.
And so I found in an atmosphere where there was no right or wrong,
mm-hmm.
And that I in an atmosphere where I was told that I couldn't make a mistake. Whatever I did was okay.
Mm-hmm.
That. What happens is then you don't make mistakes, and then you become not self-conscious,
mm-hmm.
and work gets better,
mm-hmm.
and you learn that way of attacking things. And anyway, that was a big influence on me. And you know, I had a bunch of other teachers as well, and you know, I would watch certain actors and see what they did. And it was
mm-hmm.
I remember when Laurence Olivier died. It was.
Mm-hmm.
The joke was, okay, every other actor gets to move up one notch.
There is a pecking order in the sense that...
Yeah,
you know, I mean, like, well, we can't get to you first because we got all these other people, but that's not very true, I would think, now. But back then, in reading your book, what's interesting is that, I mean, you were virtually surrounded with all these wonderful actors, whether they're character actors or not, but they certainly have established their turf.
Oh, sure, yeah. Oh, gosh, yes. I worked with, you know, I did a film with Peter Sellers, and
mm-hmm.
who was a very unique guy. I couldn't quite connect with him personally. I think
mm-hmm.
I think he was known for being kind of, I was going to say aloof, and that's the wrong word.
Mm-hmm.
He was kind of... Hard to connect with, and
mm-hmm.
so. But I remember when we were doing the work and the camera would roll, and he would just on a dime begin
mm-hmm.
exactly where we left off,
mm-hmm.
and it was as if there he was absolutely unfettered by any kind of real life sort of
mm-hmm.
constraint. He just made it work, and he was. Unpredictable and funny and just it was magnificent, and so that kind of thing is just, you know, wonderful to encounter. And you, it's a little depressing, like reading a great writer and then sitting down to write, because you know you're not going to be that good. And all you can do is aspire to be, you know, the best you can be.
Mm-hmm. And a lot of these actors were at the same time totally different when the lights are on versus when they're backstage and being themselves too.
Right, right. Yeah, absolutely so. I remember doing a movie with Jackie Gleason, and he played my father, and Maureen O'Hara was my mother, and Jackie was a kind of a brilliant performer, but mm-hmm. he had his ghosts mm-hmm. that haunted him too, and so it was rewarding, but in that particular movie, it was called How Do I Love Thee. It was based on a book by Peter DeVries, who's a wonderful satirist, New York writer, mm-hmm. and it was a pretty good script, but somehow it just didn't quite come together, and you never know for sure what's going to. Sometimes you'll see an actor you love, and you'll see them in a movie, and you'll think, oh, it's going to be good because I love this actor, and somehow the material doesn't gel, mm-hmm. and it's hard to tell why, because it does happen, you know, and mm-hmm. then on the other hand, rattling all over the place here, on the other hand, you'll see something that just looks like it's totally unpromising, the material, and it just works out like magic.
Well, you did some work with the Duke, John Wayne.
Yeah.
And I guess, obviously, in reading your book, that was before stuntmen.
Well, no, I did have a stuntman in that. The guy who fell down the stairs after that hit was not me. But thank God, because I'm not one of those people who falls well. I fall and I break things. But anyway, so yeah, he did have this. I had this scene where he put the gun in my mouth. In fact, I was watching the Academy Awards a few years ago, and it was right through the year they were doing that Brokeback Mountain was up, mm-hmm. and they were doing things with lots of, you know, sort of sexual innuendo, Western sort of things, and then they showed a picture of it was me with a Duke's gun in my mouth, and then he took me toward the front door, and then gave me a whack with it, and he cut my, it was the last film he ever did, and he wasn't as strong as he had been, I guess, but he was still, you know, he dominated the set like an oak tree in a mm-hmm. teeny backyard, but anyway, when he whacked me, he wasn't quite in control, and I had to have a couple stitches taken, and the next time I saw him, we were, I guess, back in L.A. We'd done that Carson City, mm-hmm. Nevada. And we got back to L.A., and I ran into him, and he said, sorry about that. I only ever did that once before. And he was his way of telling me that he was sorry that he almost, you know.
Well, I guess, you know, it's okay after all you've been hit by the Duke, you know.
Yeah, right. Yeah. Well, he did seem bigger than life, that man. I don't know why. He asked me what my politics were, and I said, I'm not political. He just kind of smiled at me. I had quite long hair, and I think he guessed my politics were maybe not the same as his. But, it's kind of the way I feel about politics these days. You know, politics have gotten so mm-hmm. mean sometimes,
right.
You know, you just wish people would be nice to each other, yeah.
Right. Interesting. Now, you were very close with Goldie Hawn.
Yes,
tell
I
us
was.
A little bit about that.
Well, we were it was her first big movie. I think she'd done maybe one job before that, one film job, but she was a big star in this country from Laugh-In. Mm-hmm. And so we would go out and have lunch while we were rehearsing and shooting Cactus Flower, and people would shout at her, and she was so full of life and sweet, and she was really lovely, and we were great pals for a while, and then as things happen and this I guess they call it a town, and it's actually part of a big city, but what they mean by the town is the Hollywood community, I think. And so we sort of drifted apart for reasons that have nothing to do with anything special other than that our lives went in different directions.
You've worked with several other actors.
Yeah.
You mentioned in your book about Jill Clayburgh and the work that you guys have done and worked with, and the encounter that you have with James Mason.
No, I've never worked with James Mason.
I'm trying to remember in the book. It was
I mentioned in connection with Jill, I remember mentioning
Ingrid
Al Pacino.
Bergman, I think. Yeah, Al Pacino,
Ingrid
that's
Bergman.
Right.
Oh, yeah.
Yes, yes. Yeah.
Well, Ingrid Bergman was, I love to talk about her because I was in love with her. I just instantly fell in love with her. And I think it happened to a lot of actors who worked with her. In fact, at one time I was doing a scene with her, and this was also in Cactus Flower, where I was dancing with her. And it was a slow dance, and the director said cut, and he said, "Rick, you're covering Ingrid's profile." I guess I had my hand up over her, and I thought, "Oh no, they're gonna send me to would-be movie actor hell." But she just patted me in the back of the head, and she had a reputation for being sort of having crushes on her leading men, and I wasn't her leading man. I was sort of the juvenile in the piece, but Walter Matthau was the leading man in that. But I don't think that she really had a crush on him. So I kind of convinced myself that she liked me quite a bit. And one of the things we talked about a lot was my wife's time, Jessica Raines, who was Claude Raines' daughter, and Ingrid and Claude had done Notorious together, and she told me stories about that. She actually talked to me about a lot of the films she'd done, and anyway, so I sort of think she had kind of warm feelings for me. And then I saw her in at the premiere of Cactus Flower several months later in New York, and she said, "Hi, Nick." And since that's not my name, I realized that probably she wasn't as smitten by me as I was by her.
You have a special connection with the movie Casablanca because you talk a lot about that, and certainly about the reflection about your own personal life in some ways. So tell us about that.
Well, I guess it's almost kind of weird, my connection with it, because I went to see that when I was about 6 years old, like that, and my name is Richard, and I asked my mother after the movie if I could be called Rick, the way Bogey was in Casablanca, and she kind of liked that, too, so from then on I was Rick instead of Dick. I'd already figured out that Dick didn't just feel like the name I wanted to live with for my whole life. So, and then later on I married Claude's daughter, Jessica, who is the mother of Abigail. And so I've always felt a connection with that movie. And it's sort of and then later on I knew I was kind of close to a woman who was, I guess mistress is the word, of Michael Curtiz, who directed Casablanca. And so I heard a lot about it that way, and it began to be kind of a theme that ran through my life, it seemed. And then I kind of used it in the book. In fact, I won't do a spoiler on myself, but toward the end there's a there's something that connects with Cactus Flower. I mean, with Casablanca in the story. And in the story, I kind of replace Ingrid with my wife Linda. So, yes, it is a theme.
That's wonderful. And talking about your wife, Linda, obviously she's got scent.
Oh, God, is she ever. She sure is. Yeah.
How difficult was it for you to be the husband you aspired to be for Linda?
Well, I was starting, maybe beginning to grow up when I met Linda, and so she had an advantage over my other situations. She was so kind of understanding and tolerant of my craziness and my the various things I did. And I'm not talking about any kind of thing outside the marriage, because that didn't happen. But she was just tolerant of my craziness. That's all. Mm-hmm. And she was nice. And I found that living with somebody who is, you know, operates on that level, at the same time wouldn't take any crap from me. I couldn't, you know, deal with her unfairly because she wouldn't stand for it, which is a good way to live, I guess. she inspired in me the desire to, you know, behave on the same level. Mm-hmm. So I really think she made me a better person just by being who she is and loving me no matter how, you know, what wacky things I managed to do at the beginning of my marriage. And they were just things that just were still, you know, too childish for the age that I was.
We have the inner child in us, so
yeah.
It doesn't really matter. But I get your point, because I think the book, as I mentioned to you earlier, it's a wonderful love story.
Thank you. I mean it that way. It's sort of an ongoing thing. Like, well, for this interview, I, you know, got up earlier than I normally would have, and she got up with me, we went to bed kind of late last night, she's in the other room now doing our taxes, or doing her part of the taxes, she just, everything, you know, day in, day out, it just gets better and better. I've heard people talk about, you know, how do you stay with a long marriage, and up till 30 years ago, I would have been the last one to have any discussion like that. But now I do understand how it's happening, because, you know, you can, a good person, you know, can be endlessly intriguing, and there are always new things about Linda that I discover, and they're all, and she grows in her personality and in every way.
Very interesting. Your career in the entertainment industry spanned over several decades, as we had mentioned before. Over the years, how do you measure your professional and personal success?
That's an intriguing question. During the times I've been working as an actor, you feel successful, because there are lots of times when you're not working as an actor and when you feel like the opposite. And even really successful actors with, you know, Academy Awards and so on, get between jobs and they feel, you know, they just feel at sea and as if their life doesn't mean, you know, as much as they would like it to. And I've had that same experience. For me now, I judge my success not as much in terms of, you know, my credits, my resume, professional resume, but by whether I'm able to be, to do the kind of thing I want to do, which is, you know, for me, just is in the creative arts. I'm a writer. I mean, an actor too. I beg your pardon. I'm an artist too. I forget all the things that I would like to be. And so, as long as I'm doing something that feels creative, and I'm earning at least a modest living, and sometimes that goes up and is very nice, and sometimes it's not so nice. But as long as I'm, you know, staying afloat. And being, you know, a kind interactor with my family and friends, that seems like success to me. I don't think it's fortunate I don't judge myself by Academy Awards, because or that kind of thing, because it's out of the question. It's not. Mm-hmm. It never came up. Mm-hmm. But. I guess I think working, you know, just being productive. And I think I guess it's a line from Theodore Reicke, or I think that's the way you say it. He says, without work and love, there is neurosis. And I think the other side of that is, you know, with work and love, you're successful.
Very interesting. What were some of the memorable experiences you have had on stage as well as on the movie sets?
Oh, Jesus. one movie set incident comes to my mind. I was doing a series called Heck Ramsey with Richard Boone, and it was it was Richard Boone and myself and Harry Morgan were the three running characters on it. And one time I was shooting one episode, and it was under the heading of mystery movie, NBC mystery movie, and it revolved with Columbo and Macmillan and wife. And
right. And, I remember that. Yeah.
Do you? Yeah.
Yes. Yeah.
And so I was doing an episode, and I guess we solved the crime. And during the story, I had a toothache, a terrible toothache, that I was always whining about. And right at the very end, they sit me in a chair, and I can't remember. I don't think it was Harry, but somebody pulled the tooth. Mm-hmm. And so they gave me an anesthetic for it, and I was to drink a great, huge glass of, you know, tea, which was meant to be whiskey. Mm-hmm. Only these guys, Richard Quine, the director, he directed, you know, lots of big movies. I think How to Murder Your Wife with Jack Lemmon and so on. But anyway, Richard Quine and Dick Boone and Harry Morgan. Mm-hmm. Were watching me do this scene, and I saw them there, just standing there. I thought, God, why are they doing that? Because normally, you know, they weren't in the scene. And then I realized, as I started to drink that big, and it was a 12-ounce, I think, a huge glass of tea. Mm-hmm. But it wasn't tea. It was indeed whiskey. And so I chugged down all this whiskey so as not to spoil the take.
Yeah.
And those guys were off camera just laughing their pants off. They thought that was so funny. And then there was going to be an after show rap party. And so I didn't have to do any drinking or anything during that party because that had already been done.
Very interesting.
Yeah.
Coming back to the idea of the fact that you went through a spiritual journey in itself, I mean, obviously you didn't realize it till this past few years, so
right.
to speak.
Right.
I got a lot in life from a standpoint of learning from movies, because to me, I think you can learn so much from any movie that you see if you're in the present moment, because there's constant good, bad, evil versus whatever you want to call it and so forth, characters, behavior tendencies, and everything else. Did you ever find yourself learning from the movies that you were in?
That's interesting. You know, I did a lot of comedies.
Mm-hmm.
For the most part, I would say the one thing that goes through, not so much, I can't think of that most of the movies I was in were learning, were forum for me as far as any kind of spiritual journey or in a way.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm aware of a lot of movies where, and I know it's been in my work too, on stage as well as film, that where there are considerations of, you know, fairness and justice and kindness and you know, expanding your understanding of something. And, you know, it just crosses my mind right now, the movie Tootsie from the early 80s, the Dustin Hoffman movie where he played the actress. To watch what that movie ended up being about, I actually saw a documentary feature about this movie, and where Sidney Pollack and Dustin Hoffman and Murray Shishko, who began writing it with Dustin in the first place, and Elaine May, and really smart people. What happens to the, and I suppose people who know this movie already know this, and so forgive me if I'm being repetitious, I remember Sidney Pollack saying this is not an important movie message, but my feeling was that it was, that it really kind of called attention to a man finding out what has happened to people who are, to women who are treated in a way and have been for and had been more so at that point in time been treated as though they were second class or sort of objects, and I think anything that kind of expands your consciousness and makes you aware of the fact that that we're all that everybody's that you should be kind to everybody because everybody's fighting a great battle, and
interesting. Do you consider yourself as being a comedian?
I think it's Edmund Gwenn was credited with the line of the deathbed line of dying is easy, comedy is hard. And I'm not sure. he was being funny, but comedy is hard. It really is. When people say that, I think it was Sidney Pollack. I remember saying that with drama, there are a number of ways you can do something. You can play a scene. You can get to a moment and make it work. With comedy, very often it is really only one way to do it, and if you do it with an extra beat left in where it shouldn't be, it doesn't work. And it could be as simple as I remember doing a play at the Mark Taper Forum in L.A. Once in a Lifetime by Kaufman and Hart, and I did the George Kaufman role, and I was working with a wonderful actress named Marcia Rodd, and it was at a scene where we're coming back from Hollywood, and we're reading the reviews of this movie that we've been involved with, and I remember finding a moment. You hear actors talking about this all the time; it's boring as hell. It can be, but I remember saying what there was a non sequitur line that I had, and I said, and this takes place, I guess, in the 20s, after the whole scene is over, where the discussion, where they've read the play and everybody's we're looking at each other kind of dryly, and then I said, "I see the boll weevils into the cotton crop again," and it never worked. And I was during previews, and I just remember realizing that if I tapped the paper at another point, where we hadn't been reading, where I hadn't been reading, that it made all the difference, and the laugh was huge. And it's a dumb thing, but these sort of things are just really fun to find. And I really think I'm going on and on about this thing, and maybe boring.
Not at all. That's the natural you. I mean, I'm sure just in our conversation on the air. You are a funny person at home as well, in person.
Well, sometimes my wife may be a little, she's heard my jokes, but thank you.
I mean, that's part of a relationship building.
Oh, yeah. Oh, God. I think humor is so important to a marriage and to any long-term relationship. You just better see the funny sides or you're in trouble.
Right. Yeah. Where can someone go to buy your book, get more information about you, and keep up with your latest happenings?
Oh, well, they could go to I have a website, which is ricklensauthor.com, and that's you can find about the book and me that way. And I think some of the usual sources like Amazon and Barnes & Noble and I hope soon, if not yet, your local bookstore will have it. And in the meantime, those other outlets certainly do have it. And and we're about to go into the second printing, which is good news. And it's available, and either Amazon or Barnes & Noble, or, as I say, my website, ricklanzarauthor.com.
Fantastic. By the way, Rick, we're coming close to the end of the show. Do you have a recipe for living you would like to share with our listeners this morning?
Oh, sure. I think so. I think I would say, I know it's a cliche now, but I think follow your bliss as much as you can, you know, work it out to be able to do that without hurting other people, and be kind to everybody you encounter, because I think I said this line before, everybody you meet is fighting a great battle. That's somebody else's line, I'm not sure whose, but it is true. Everyone has their own burden they're bearing, and you don't know what it is in most cases, and you should allow for the fact that it is the truth. And then I think beyond that, I think find your mate, but not before you feel it, that it's the right thing in your gut. And after you've done that, just love her forever. And I think that kind of covers it for me.
Fantastic. Those are wonderful recipes for living. How has writing this book impacted you personally?
You know, it's been cathartic. It really has been, it's been both a feeling of accomplishment, and it got some of the stuff out that I might not have been able to express any other way, and it would have just stayed in there and kind of just dwelled in the back corners of my mind forever. But I was able to tell some stories that I really wanted to tell and weave them together, and so I felt a great sense of accomplishment in doing it, and whether it's justified, I guess time will tell. My wife and my kids so far like it, and my friends, and it's doing nicely. So it was a joy. It was actually, I say on my website, I mentioned briefly that it was painful to write, and it was, because I dealt with, my sister dealt with a really hard problem, and also, as I say, my daughter, and it's painful to have to bring up, troubles that, when you've gotten through the pain and the problem is, gone away, and it's nice to have been able to talk about it make some kind of as much sense as you can possibly make out of the problems that come your way.
Well, Rick, thank you so much for the great recipe for living that you have shared with us earlier, and wonderful story that you have shared with us at the same time. To all our listeners, thank you for being with us this morning. Please join me in 3 weeks, Tuesday, April 3rd. My guest will be author Margie Jelwesser. Her latest book, titled Pieces of Us, deals with cyberbullying among teenagers. For additional information about this show, future shows, and to receive a free recipe for living, please go to FromMyMamasKitchen.com. Thank you for listening. Have a great week. And Rick, thank you again, and have a great day.
Thank you so much, Johnny. Bye-bye.
Thank you. Bye-bye.